Green Mars, Cassette 8.
Sax continued to sleep poorly, and though he spent his days in the ordinary routines of work and habit, it seemed that he saw things differently than he had before the conference. Another proof, he supposed glumly, of the notion of vision as a paradigm construct. But now it was so obvious the transnationals were everywhere. In terms of authority, there was hardly anything else. Burroughs was a transnat town, and from what Phyllis had said, Sheffield was too. There were none of the national scientific teams that had proliferated in the years before the treaty conference, and with the first 100 dead or in hiding, the whole tradition of Mars as a research station was extinct. What science there was devoted to the terraforming project, and he had seen what kind of science that was becoming. No, the research was applied only these days. And there were very few other signs of the old nation-states now that he looked. The news gave the impression that they were mostly bankrupt, even the Group of Seven, and the transnats were holding the debts, if anybody was. Some reports made Sax think that in a sense, the transnats were even taking on smaller countries as a kind of capital asset in a new business-government arrangement that went far beyond the old flag-of-convenience contracts. An example of this new arrangement in a slightly different form was Mars itself, which seemed effectively in the possession of the big transnats. And now that the elevator was back, the export of metals and the import of people and goods had vastly accelerated. Terran stock markets were ballooning hysterically to mark the action, with no end in sight, despite the fact that Mars could only provide Terra with certain metals in certain quantities. So the stock market rise was probably some kind of bubble phenomenon, and if it burst, it might very well be enough to bring everything down again. Or perhaps not. Economics was a bizarre field, and there were senses in which the whole stock market was simply too unreal to have impacts beyond itself. But who knew till it happened? Sax, wandering the streets of Burroughs, looking at the stock market displays in the office windows, certainly didn't claim to. People were not rational systems. This profound truth was reinforced when Desmond showed up one evening at his door. The famous coyote himself, the stowaway, big man's little bro, standing there small and slight in a brightly colored construction worker's jumper, diagonal slashes of aquamarine and royal blue leading the eye down to lime green walker boots. Many construction workers in Burroughs, and there were a lot of them, wore the new light and flexible walker boots all the time as a kind of fashion statement, and all were brightly colored, but very few achieved the stunning quality of Desmond's fluorescent greens. He grinned his cracked grin as Sax stared at them. "Yes, so beautiful, aren't they? And very distracting." Which was just as well, as his dreadlocks were stuffed into a voluminous red, yellow, and green beret, an unusual sight anywhere on Mars. "Come on, let's go out for a drink." He led Sax down to a cheap canalside bar built into the side of a massive emptied pingo. The construction crowd here was tightly packed around long tables and sounded mostly Australian. At the canalside itself, a particularly rowdy group were throwing ice shot puts the size of cannonballs out into the canal, and very occasionally thumping one down on the grass of the far bank, which caused cheers and often a round of nitrous oxide for the house. Strollers on the far bank were giving that part of the canal side a wide berth. Desmond got them four shots of tequila and one nitrous inhaler.
"Pretty soon we'll have agave cactus growing on the surface, eh?"
"I think you could do it now." They sat at the end of one table with their elbows bumping and Desmond talking into Sax's ear as they drank. He had a whole wish list of things he wanted Sax to steal from Biotique. Seed stocks, spores, rhizomes, certain growth media, certain hard-to-synthesize chemicals.
"Hiroko says to tell you she really needs all of it, but especially the seeds."
"Can't she breed those herself? I don't like taking things."
"Life is a dangerous game," Desmond said, toasting the thought with a big whiff of nitrous, followed by a shot of tequila. "Ah! he said. It's not the danger, Sax said. I just don't like doing it. I work with those people. Desmond shrugged and didn't answer. It occurred to Sax that these scruples might strike Desmond, who had spent most of the 21st century living by theft, as a bit overfine.
You won't be taking it from those people, Desmond said at last. You'll be taking it from the Transnat that owns Biotique.
But that's a Swiss collective, and Praxis, Sax said. And Praxis doesn't look so bad. It's a very loose egalitarian system. It reminds me of Hiroko's, actually.
Except that they're part of a global system that has a fairly small oligarchy running the world. You have to remember the context.
Oh, believe me, I do, Sax said, remembering his sleepless nights. But you have to make distinctions as well.
Yes, yes. And one distinction is that Hiroko needs these materials and cannot make them, given the necessity to hide from the police hired by your wonderful transnational.
Sax blinked disgruntledly.
Besides, theft of materials is one of the few resistance actions left to us these days. Hiroko has agreed with Maya that obvious sabotage is simply an announcement of the underground's existence and an invitation for reprisal and a shutdown of the demimonde. Better simply to disappear for a while, she says, and make them think that we never existed in any great numbers.
It's a good idea, Sax said, but I'm surprised you're doing what Hiroko says.
Very funny, Desmond said with a grimace. Anyway, I think it's a good idea, too.
You do?
No, but she talked me into it. It may be for the best. Anyway, there's still a lot of materials to be obtained.
Won't theft itself tip off the police that we're still out there?
No way. It's so widespread that what we do can't be noticed against the background levels. There's a whole lot of inside jobs.
Like me?
Yes, but you're not doing it for money, are you?
I still don't like it. Desmond laughed, revealing his stone eye tooth and the odd asymmetricality of his jaw and his whole lower face.
It's hostage syndrome. You work with them and you get to know them and have a sympathy for them. You have to remember what they're doing here. Come on, finish that cactus and I'll show you some things you haven't seen right here in Burrows.
There was a commotion as an ice shot had hit the other bank and rolled up the grass and bowled over an old man. People were cheering and lifting the woman who had made the throw onto their shoulders, but the group with the old man was charging down to the nearest bridge.
This place is getting too noisy, Desmond said. Come on, drink that and let's go.
Sax knocked back the liquor while Desmond popped the last of the inhaler. Then they left quickly to avoid the developing brouhaha walking up the canal-side path. A half-hour's walk took them past the rows of Barice columns and up into Princess Park, where they turned right and walked up the steep, wide, grassy incline of Thoth Boulevard. Beyond Table Mountain, they turned left down a narrower swath of street grass and came to the westernmost part of the tent wall, extending in a big arc around Black Syrtis Mesa.
Look, they're getting back to the old coffin quarters for workers again, Desmond pointed out. That's Subarashi's standard housing now, but see how these units are set into the mesa? Black Syrtis contained a plutonium processing plant in the early days of Burrows when it was well out of town. But now Subarashi has built workers' quarters right next to it, and their jobs are to oversee the processing and the removal of waste north to Nilai Fossi, where some integral fast reactors will use it. The cleanup operation used to be almost completely robotic, but the robots are hard to keep online. They've found it's cheaper to use people for a lot of the jobs.
But the radiation, Sax said, blinking.
Yes, Desmond said with his savage grin. They take on 40 rem a year. You're kidding. I am not kidding. They tell the workers this and give them hardship pay, and after 3 years they get a bonus, which is the treatment.
Is it withheld from them otherwise?
It's expensive, Sax, and there are waiting lists. This is a way to skip up the list and cover the costs.
But 40 rems.
There's no way to be sure the treatment will repair the damage that could do.
We know that, Desmond said with a scowl.
There was no need to refer to Simon.
But they don't.
And Tsubarashi is doing this just to cut costs?
That's important in such a large capital investment, Sax. All kinds of cost-cutting measures are showing up. The sewage systems in Black Cirrus are all the same system, for instance. The med clinic and the coffins and the plants and the mesa.
You're kidding.
I am not kidding. My jokes are funnier than that.
Sax waved him off.
Look, Desmond said, there are no regulatory agencies anymore, no building codes or whatever. That is what the transnational success in 61 really means. They make their own rules now. And you know what their one rule is.
But this is simply stupid.
Well, you know, this particular division of Tsubarashi is run by Georgians, and they're in the grip of a big Stalin revival there. It's a patriotic gesture to run their country as stupidly as possible. That means business, too. And, of course, the top managers of Tsubarashi are still Japanese, and they believe Japan became great by being tough. They say they won in 61 what they lost in World War II. They're the most brutal transnat up here, but all the rest are imitating them to compete successfully. Praxis is an anomaly in that sense. You must remember that.
So we reward them by stealing from them.
You're the one who went to work for Biotique. Maybe you should change jobs.
No.
Do you think you can get these materials from one of Tsubarashi's firms?
No.
But you could from Biotique.
Probably. Security is pretty tight.
But you could do it.
Probably. Sax thought about it. I want something in return.
Yes?
Will you fly me out to have a look at this Saleta burn zone?
Certainly. I would like to see it again myself.
So the next afternoon they left Burroughs and trained south up the Great Escarpment, getting off at Libya Station some 70 kilometers from Burroughs. There they slipped into the basement and their closet door, down their tunnel and out into the rocky countryside. Down in a shallow graben, they found one of Desmond's cars, and when night came, they drove east along the escarpment to a small red hideout in the rim of Dumarthurey Crater, next to a stretch of flat bedrock the Reds used as an airstrip. Desmond did not identify Sax to their hosts. They were led into a little cliffside hangar where they got into one of Spencer's old stealth planes and taxied out to the bedrock, then took off in an undulant acceleration down the runway. Once in the air, they flew east slowly through the night. They flew in silence for a while. Sax saw lights on the dark surface of the planet only 3 times. Once a station in Escalante Crater, once the tiny moving line of lights of a round-the-world train, and the last, an unidentified blink in the rough land behind the Great Escarpment. Who do you think that is? Sax asked.
No idea.
After a few minutes more, Sax said, I ran into Phyllis.
Really? Did she recognize you?
No, Desmond laughed.
That's Phyllis for you.
A lot of old acquaintances haven't recognized me.
Yeah, but Phyllis. Is she still president of the Transitional Authority?
No, she didn't seem to think it was a powerful post anyway. Desmond laughed again.
A silly woman. But she did get that group on Clark back to civilization, I'll give her that. I thought they were goners myself.
Do you know much about that?
I talked with 2 of the people who were on it, yeah. One night in Burroughs at the Pingo Bar, in fact, you couldn't get them to shut up about it.
Did anything happen near the end of their flight?
The end? Well, yeah, someone died. I guess some woman got a hand crushed when they were evacuating Clark, and Phyllis was the closest thing they had to a doctor, so Phyllis took care of her through the whole trip and thought she was going to make it.
But I guess they ran out of something, the two telling me the story weren't too clear on it, and she took a turn for the worse. Phyllis called a prayer meeting for her and prayed for her, but she died anyway, a couple of days before they came into the Terran system.
Ah, Sack said, then. Phyllis doesn't seem all that religious anymore.
Desmond snorted. She was never religious, if you ask me. Hers was the religion of business. You visit real Christians like the folks down in Christianopolis or Bingen, and you don't find them talking prophets at breakfasts and lording it over you with that horrible, unctuous righteousness they have. Righteousness, good Lord. It's a most unpleasant quality in a person. You know, it has to be a house built on sand, eh? But the demi-monde Christians are not like that. They're Gnostics, Quakers, Baptists, Baha'i, Rastafarians, whatever. The most agreeable people in the underground, if you ask me, and I've traded with everybody. So helpful, and no airs about being best friends with Jesus. They're tight with Hiroko and the Sufis as well. Some kind of mystic networking going on down there, he cackled. But Phyllis now, and all those business fundamentalists using religion to cover extortion, I hate that. Actually, I never heard Phyllis speak in a religious manner after we landed.
Did you have much opportunity to hear Phyllis speak after we landed?
Another laugh. More than you might think. I saw more than you did in those years, Mr. Lab Man. I had my little hidey holes everywhere.
Sax made a skeptical noise, and Desmond shouted a laugh and slapped him on the shoulder.
Who else could tell you that you and Hiroko were an item in the Underhill years, eh? Oh yes, I saw a lot. Of course, you could make that particular observation about practically any man in Underhill and be right. That vixen was keeping us all as a harem.
Polyandry?
Two-timing, goddammit, or 20-timing?
Desmond laughed at him. Just after dawn, they caught sight of a white column of smoke obscuring the stars over a whole quadrant of the sky. For a while, this dense cloud was the only anomaly they could see in the landscape. Then, as they flew on and the terminator of the planet rolled under them, a broad swath of bright ground appeared on the eastern horizon ahead, an orange strip or trough running roughly northeast to southwest across the land, obscured by smoke that poured out of one section of it. The trough under the smoke was white and turbulent, as if a small volcanic eruption were confined to that one spot. Above it stood a beam of light, a beam of illuminated smoke, rather, so tight and solid that it was like a physical pillar, extending straight up and becoming less distinct as the cloud smoke thinned and disappearing where the smoke reached its maximum height of around 10,000 meters. At first there was no sign of the origin of this beam in the sky. The aerial lens was some 400 kilometers overhead, after all. Then Sax thought he saw something like the ghost of a cloud soaring very far above. Maybe that was it, maybe it wasn't. Desmond wasn't sure. At the foot of the pillar of light, however, there was no question of visibility. The pillar of light had a kind of biblical presence, and the melted rock under it was truly incandescent, a very brilliant white. That was what 5,000 degrees Kelvin looked like exposed to the open air.
We have to be careful, Desmond said. We fly into that beam and it would be like a moth in a flame.
I'm sure the smoke is very turbulent as well.
Yes, I plan to stay windward of it.
Down where the pillar of lit smoke met the orange channel, new smoke was spewing out in violent billows, weirdly lit from underneath. To the north of the white spot, where the rock had a chance to cool, the melted channel reminded Sax of film of the eruptions of the Hawaiian volcanoes. Bright yellow-orange waves surged north in the channel of fluid rock, occasionally meeting resistances and splashing up onto the dark banks of the molten channel. The channel was about 2 kilometers wide and ran over the horizon in both directions. They could see perhaps 200 kilometers of it.
South of the Pillar of Light, the channel bed was almost covered with cooling black rock webbed by dark orange cracks. The straightness of the channel and the Pillar of Light itself were the only obvious signs that it was not some kind of natural lava channel, but these signs were more than enough. Besides, there hadn't been any volcanic activity on the surface of Mars for many thousands of years. Desmond closed on the site, then banked their plane sharply and headed north.
The beam from the aerial lens is moving south, so up the line we should be able to fly closer.
For many kilometers, the channel of melted rock ran northeast without changing. Then as they got farther away from the current burn zone, the orange of the lava darkened and began to cake over from the sides with a black surface, broken by more orange cracks. Beyond that, the channel surface was black, as were the banks on each side of it, a straight swath of pure black running over the rust-colored highlands of Hesperia. Desmond banked and turned south again and flew closer to the channel. He was a rough pilot, shoving the light plane around ruthlessly. When the orange cracks reappeared, a thermal updraft bucked the plane hard and he slid to the west a little. The light of the molten rock itself illuminated the banks of the channel, which appeared to be smoking lines of hills, very black.
I thought they were supposed to be glass, Sack said. Obsidian. Actually, I've seen some different colors. Swirls of various minerals in the glass.
How far does this burn extend?
They're cutting from Cerberus to Hellas, running just west of Tirrhenia and Hadriaca volcanoes.
Sax whistled.
They say it will be a canal between the Hellas Sea and the Northern Ocean.
Yes, yes, but they're volatizing carbonates much too fast.
Thickens the atmosphere, right?
Yes, but with CO2. They're wrecking the plan. We won't be able to breathe the atmosphere for years. We'll be stuck in the cities.
Maybe they think they'll be able to scrub the CO2 out when things are warmed up.
Desmond glanced at him.
Have you seen enough?
More than enough. Desmond laughed his unsettling laugh and banked the plane sharply. They began to chase the Terminator to the west, flying low over the long shadows of the dawn terrain.
Think about it, Sax. For a while, people are forced to stay in the cities, which is convenient if you want to keep control of things. You burn cuts with this flying magnifying glass, and fairly quickly you have your one bar atmosphere and your warm, wet planet. Then you have some method of scrubbing the air of carbon dioxide. They must have something in mind, industrial or biological or both. Something they can sell, no doubt. And presto, you have another Earth, and very quickly. It might be expensive.
It's definitely expensive. All these big projects must be setting the transnationals back by huge amounts, and they're doing it even though we're a good step on the way to 273 Kelvin. I don't get it.
Maybe they feel 273 is too modest. An average of freezing is a bit chilly, after all. Kind of a Sax Russell vision of terraforming, you might call that. Practical, but...
he cackled.
Or maybe they're feeling rushed. Earth is in a mess, Sax.
I know that, Sax said sharply. I've been studying it.
Good for you. No, really. So you know that the people who haven't got the treatment are getting desperate. They're getting older, and their chances of ever getting it seem to be getting worse. And the people who have gotten the treatment, especially the ones at the top, are looking around trying to figure out what to do. 61 taught them what can happen if things get out of control. So they're buying up countries like bad mangoes at the end of market day, but it doesn't seem to be helping. And here, right next door, they see a fresh, empty planet, not quite ready for occupation, but close, full of potential. It could be a new world, beyond the reach of the untreated billions.
Sax thought it over. A kind of bolt hole, you mean? To escape to if there's trouble.
Exactly. I think there are people in these transnationals who want Mars terraformed just as quickly as possible by any means necessary.
Ah, Sax said, and was silent all the way back. Desmond accompanied him back into Burrows, and as they walked from South Station to Hunt Mesa, they could see across the treetops of Canal Park, through the slot between Branch Mesa and Table Mountain, to Black Syrtis. "Are they really doing things as stupid as that all over Mars?" Sack said. Desmond nodded.
"I will bring you a list next time."
"Do that." Sack shook his head as he pondered it. "It doesn't make sense. It doesn't take into account the long run.
They are short-run thinkers.
But they're going to live a long time. Presumably they'll still be in charge when these policies collapse on them.
They may not see it that way. They change jobs a lot up at the top. They try to establish a reputation by building a company very quickly, then get hired upwards somewhere else, then try to do it again. It's musical chairs up there."
"It won't matter what chair they're in, it's the whole room that's going to come down. They aren't paying attention to the laws of physics."
"Of course not. Haven't you noticed that before, Sax?"
"I guess not." Of course he had seen that human affairs were irrational and unexplainable. This no one could miss. But he realized now that he had been making the assumption that the people who involved themselves in governance were making a good-faith effort to run things in a rational manner with a view to the long-term well-being of humanity and its biophysical support system. Desmond laughed at him as he tried to express this, and irritably he exclaimed, "But why else take on such compromised work if not to that end?"
"Power," Desmond said. "Power and gain."
Sax had always been so uninterested in those things that it was hard for him to understand why anyone else would be. What was personal gain but the freedom to do what you wanted to do? And what was power but the freedom to do what you wanted to do? And once you had that freedom, any more wealth or power actually began to restrict one's options and reduce one's freedom. One became a servant of one's wealth or power, constrained to spend all one's time protecting it. So that, properly seen, the freedom of a scientist with a lab at his command was the highest freedom possible. Any more wealth and power only interfered with that. Desmond was shaking his head as Sax described this philosophy.
"Some people like to tell others what to do. They like that more than freedom. Hierarchy, you know. And their place in the hierarchy, as long as it's high enough. Everyone bound into their places. It's safer than freedom. And a lot of people are cowards."
Sax shook his head. "I think it's simply an inability to understand the concept of diminishing returns, as if there can never be too much of a good thing. It's very unrealistic. I mean, there is no process in nature that is a constant, irrespective of quantity.
Speed of light? Bah! Irrelevant. Physical reality is clearly not a factor in these calculations."
"Well put." Sax shook his head, frustrated. "Religion again. Or ideology. What was it Frank used to say? An imaginary relationship to a real situation?
There was a man who loved power."
"True.
But he was very imaginative."
They stopped at Sax's apartment and changed clothes, then went up to the top of the mesa to get breakfast at Antonio's. Sax was still thinking about their discussion. "The problem is that people with a hypertrophied regard for wealth and power achieve positions that give them these gifts in excess, and then they find that they're as much slaves to them as masters, and then they become dissatisfied and bitter."
"Like Frank, you mean?"
"Yes. So the powerful almost always seem to have a dysfunctional aspect to them. Everything from cynicism to full-blown destructiveness, they're not happy."
"But they are powerful."
"Yes, and thus our problem. Human affairs..." Sax paused to eat one of the rolls just brought to their table. He was famished. "You know, they ought to be run according to principles of systems ecology." Desmond laughed out loud, hastily grabbing up a napkin to clean off his chin. He laughed so hard that people at other tables looked over at them, worrying Sack somewhat.
"What a concept!" he cried and started to laugh again. "Ah! Ha! Ha! Oh, my saxifrage! Scientific management, eh?"
"Well, why not?" Sack said mulishly. "I mean, the principles governing the behavior of the dominant species in a stable ecosystem are fairly straightforward, as I recall. I'll bet a council of ecologists could construct a program that would result in a stable, benign society."
"If only you ran the world," Desmond cried and started laughing again.
He put his face right down on the table and howled.
"Not just me." "No, I am joking," he composed himself. "You know, Vlad and Marina have been working on their eco-economics for years now. They have even had me using it in the trade between the underground colonies."
"I didn't know that," Sack said, surprised. Desmond shook his head.
"You have to pay more attention, Sax. In the South, we've lived by eco-economics for years now."
"I'll have to look into that."
"Yes."
Desmond grinned widely, on the verge of cracking up yet again.
"You have a lot to learn."
Their orders arrived with a carafe of orange juice, and Desmond poured their glasses full. He clinked his glass against Sax's, offered a toast.
"Welcome to the revolution."
Desmond left for the South, having extracted a promise that Sax would pilfer what he could from Biotique for Hiroko.
"I've got to go meet Nergal."
He gave Sax a hug and was gone. A month or so passed, during which Sax thought about all he had learned from Desmond and the videos, sifting through it slowly, getting more and more disturbed as he did. His sleep was still broken nearly every night by hours of wakefulness. Then one morning, after one of these restless, fruitless bouts of insomnia, Sax got a call on his wrist pad. It was Phyllis, in town for meetings, and she wanted to get together for dinner. Sax agreed, with his surprise and Stephen's enthusiasm. He met her that evening at Antonio's. They kissed in the European style and were led to one of the corner tables overlooking the city. There they ate a meal that Sax scarcely noticed, talking inconsequentially about the latest events in Sheffield and Biotique. After cheesecake, they lingered over brandies. Sax was in no hurry to leave, as he wasn't sure what Phyllis had in mind for afterward. She had given no clear sign, and she seemed in no hurry either. Now she leaned back in her chair and regarded him cheerfully.
"It really is you, isn't it?"
Sax tilted his head to indicate his incomprehension. Phyllis laughed.
"It's hard to believe, really. You were never like this in the old days, Sax Russell. I wouldn't have guessed in 100 years that you would be such a lover."
Sax squinted uncomfortably and looked around. "I would hope that says more about you than me," he said with Stephen's insouciance. The nearby tables were all empty, and the waiters were leaving them alone. The restaurant would close in a half hour or so. Phyllis laughed again, but her eyes had a hard look to them, and suddenly Sax saw that she was angry. Embarrassed, no doubt, at being fooled by a man she had known for some 80 years, and angry that he had decided to fool her. And why not? It showed a very fundamental lack of trust, after all, especially from someone who was sleeping with you. The bad faith of his behavior at Arena was coming back to him with a vengeance, making him quite queasy. But what to do about it? He recalled that moment in the elevator when she had kissed him, when he had been similarly nonplussed, taken aback first by her non-recognition and now by her recognition. It had a certain symmetry, and both times he had gone along with it.
"Don't you have anything more to say?" Phyllis demanded.
He spread his hands.
"What makes you think this?"
Again she laughed angrily, then regarded him with lips tight.
"It's so easy to see it now," she said. "They just gave you a nose and a chin, I suppose. But the eyes are the same, and the head shape. It's funny what you remember and what you forget.
That's true. Actually, it was not a matter of forgetting, but of being unable to recollect. Sax suspected the memories were still there, in storage.
I can't really remember your old face, Phyllis said. To me, you were always in a lab with your nose pressing a screen. You might as well have worn a white lab coat. That's the way I see you in my memories. A kind of giant lab rat.
Now her eyes were glittering.
But somewhere along the line you managed to learn to imitate human behavior pretty well, didn't you?
Well, enough to fool an old friend who liked the way you looked. We are not old friends.
No, she snapped. I guess we're not. You and your old friends tried to kill me. And they did kill thousands of other people and destroyed most of this planet. And obviously they're still out there, or else you wouldn't be here, would you? In fact, they must be pretty widespread, because when I ran a DNA check on your sperm, the official TA records had you as Stephen Lindholm. That put me off the trail for a while, but there was something about you that made me wonder. When we fell in that crevasse, that did it. It reminded me of something that happened when we were in Antarctica. You and Tatiana Durova and I were up on Nussbaum Regal when Tatiana tripped and sprained her ankle, and it got windy and late, and they had to helicopter us back down to the base, and while we were waiting, you found some kind of rock lichen.
Sax shook his head, truly surprised. I don't remember that. And he didn't. The year of training and evaluation in Antarctica's dry valleys had been intense, but now the entire year was a dim blur to him, and that incident wouldn't come back at all. It was hard to believe it had happened. He couldn't even remember what poor Tatiana Durova had looked like. Absorbed in his thoughts, and in a concerted push for his memories of that year, he missed a bit of what Phyllis was saying, but then he caught, "Checked again with one of my old copies of my AI's memory, and there you were." "Your AI's memory units may be degrading," he said absently. "They're finding that the circuitry tends to get scrambled by cosmic radiation if it isn't reinforced from time to time." She ignored that weak sally.
"The point is, people who can change transitional authority records like that are still worth watching out for. I'm afraid I can't just let this pass, even if I wanted to."
"What do you mean?"
"I'm not sure. It depends what you do. You could just tell me where you were hiding and who with and what's going on. You just showed up at Beatique a year ago, after all. Where were you before that?"
"On Earth." Her smile had a bad twist to it.
"If that's the course you take, I'll be forced to ask for help from some of my associates. There are security people in Casey Vallis who will be able to refresh your memory."
"Come on."
"I don't mean that metaphorically. They won't beat the information out of you or anything like that. It's more a matter of extraction. They put you under, stimulate the hippocampus and the amygdala, and ask questions. People simply answer."
Sax considered this. The mechanisms of memory were still very poorly understood, but no doubt something crude could be applied to the areas they knew were involved. Fast MRI, point-specific ultrasound, who knew what? It would surely be dangerous, however.
"Well,"
Phyllis said. He stared at her smile, so angry and triumphant. A sneer. Random thoughts flickered through his mind, images without words. Desmond, Hiroko, the kids in Zygote shouting, "Why, Sax, why?" He had to hold his face steady to keep it from revealing his dislike for her, suddenly pouring through him in a wave. Perhaps this sort of distaste was what people called hatred. After a time, he cleared his throat. "I suppose I'd rather just tell you." She nodded firmly, as if this was the decision she would have made herself. She looked around. The whole restaurant was empty now, the waiters sitting at one table, nursing glasses of grappa.
"Come on," she said. "Let's go to my offices."
Sax nodded and rose stiffly. His right leg had gone asleep.
He limped after her. They said goodnight to the mobilizing waiters and left. They got into the elevator, and Phyllis punched the button for the subway level. The door closed, and they dropped. In an elevator again. Sachs took a deep breath, then jerked his head down as if to look at something unusual on the control panel. Phyllis followed his gaze, and with a jerky motion, he slugged her on the side of the jaw. She crashed into the side of the elevator and collapsed in a heap, dazed and breathing in gasps. The two biggest knuckles of his right hand hurt horribly. He hit the button for the floor two above the subway, which had a long passageway through Hunt Mesa, lined with shops that would be closed at this hour. He grabbed Phyllis by the armpits and hauled her up. She was taller than him, loose and heavy. And when the elevator door opened, he prepared himself to shout for help. But no one stood outside the door, and he pulled one of her arms over his neck and dragged her over to one of the little carts that sat by the elevator for the convenience of people who wanted to cross the mesa quickly or with a load. He dumped her onto the back seat, and she groaned, sounding as if she was coming too. He sat down ahead of her in the driver's seat and stomped the accelerator pedal to the floor, and the little vehicle hummed down the hallway. He found he was breathing hard and sweating. He passed a pair of restrooms and stopped the cart. Phyllis rolled helplessly off the seat and onto the floor, moaning louder than ever. Soon she would regain consciousness if she hadn't already. He got out and ran over to see if the men's room was unlocked. It was, so he ran to the cart and pulled Phyllis up by the shoulders, up and over his back. He staggered under her weight until he reached the men's room door, then flopped her down. Her head cracked against the concrete floor and her moaning stopped. He opened the door and pulled her through it, then closed and locked it. He sat on the bathroom floor beside her, gasping. She was still breathing and her pulse was shallow but steady. She seemed okay, but knocked out even more definitively than when he had hit her. Her skin was pale and damp, and her mouth hung open. He felt sorry for her until he remembered her threat to give him to security technicians to tear his secrets out of him. Their methods were advanced, but still it was torture. And if they had succeeded, they would know about the refuges in the South and all the rest. Once they had a general idea of what he knew, they could coax the specifics out of him. It wouldn't be possible to resist their combinations of drugs and behavior modification. And even now, Phyllis knew too much. The fact that he had such a good false ID implied a whole infrastructure that up until now had been hidden. Once they knew of its existence, they could probably ferret it out. Hiroko, Desmond, Spencer, who was deep in the system in Casey Valles, all exposed. Nergal and Jackie, Peter, Anne, all of them. Because he had not been clever enough to avoid a stupid, awful woman like Phyllis. He looked around the men's room. It was the size of two toilet stalls, one stall with a toilet, the other with a sink, a mirror, and the usual wall of dispensers, sterility pills, recreational gases. He stared at these, catching his breath and thinking things over. As plans tumbled in his mind, he whispered instructions to the AI in his wrist pad. Desmond had given him some very destructive viral programs, and he plugged his wrist pad into Phyllis's and waited for the transfers to take place. With luck, he could crash her entire system. Personal security measures were nothing against Desmond's military-based viruses, or so Desmond claimed.
This ends side one of cassette 8. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.